Hello to each of you, my friends. It's good to be here again. I use that song as a rough guide for my thoughts this morning. But before we look more directly at that, I would like to preface my topic with a short biographical sketch of my life, our journey with dystonia. For the first 8 years of my life, I was a normal farm boy. I was going to grow up and be a dairy farmer. But that all changed when I was about 8 years old. Dale, what's wrong? I still remember the alarm in my mother's voice when she asked that. Once again, we were just taking a walk and I would just trip. It's when I'd run, but after a while, just when I'd be walking, I would just trip. My left foot began to curl in and the toes pull under. We were sent to Elizabethtown Crippled Children's Hospital. And I still remember Daddy, Mommy picking me up, and Myerstown's going down 422 up toward Lebanon, and the tears started, and oh, Daddy tried to comfort his little boy. I don't think you have to worry. I don't think the doctors are going to hurt you. But then Mom was crying too. She knew that her little boy wasn't worried about that, but he didn't want to be a crippled boy. He didn't want to go to Crippled Children's Hospital. Well, we went there, and the doctors put me through everything. Of course, the diagnostic tools weren't primitive then in the early and mid-70s. But they said, well, we're just going to call you the little boy with the mystery foot because we don't know what's wrong with you. Everything seems normal otherwise. The only connection they could make was possible brain damage from a fall I'd had about 9 months before that. So we went home. A year later, my right foot became involved, inverted the other way, then my right hand and my left hand, and eventually my trunk and my head and neck were all involved in the grip of dystonia. What is dystonia? Some of you probably with other conditions like CP patients, maybe your doctor has described your dystonic movements. Dystonia is involuntary muscle spasms. Your muscles are in pairs, contractors, and extensors. So when you're trying to do this, both sets of the pair will contract, and then you have to work against it. And so, my body was just constantly pulling all the time. And it was living was hard work. I was just pouring sweat, summer and winter. My muscles were pulling abnormally all the time, except while sleeping, I could relax. We went through years, several decades of not knowing what's wrong. In my mid-20s, after about 20 years of mystery and misdiagnoses, including some wacky, well, it's dental stress, or it's all based because of unresolved emotional problems, we were referred by a medical doctor to Hershey Medical Center to a neurosurgeon. This doctor wanted me to go and have an MRI to check for a possible spinal cord injury from that fall many years before. It seemed like kind of a strange thing to recommend decades later, but God's hand was in that. Because we went to Hershey and sat in the neurosurgeon's office, in about half a minute, he looked at his intern and said, I believe we have a patient here with some form of dystonia. That was the first we'd ever heard the word. But we were on the path to discovery and eventually treatment. He sent me immediately up to the neurological department, away from the neurosurgery department. Didn't take Dr. Radichak long to say, you have a form of dystonia called musculorum deformans, Latin, but you can translate muscle deformation. I tore into the public library and did all kinds of research, didn't come up with a whole lot, but did find out that it's oftentimes a genetic condition. Several years later, I saw an ad in a Mennonite Weekly Review. It was a liberal Mennonite newspaper that my dad got, and there was a little ad calling for people of the Mennonites and Amish who have dystonia to participate in a research study. So I eventually contacted these people, and Dr. Mitchell Brin, he's now the CON of Allergan Pharmaceuticals, and his family came down from New York City to our farm there, and my parents and siblings came, and they put us all through the paces, the videoing, and those of you who know the neurological test, tap, 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 and touch my nose and all that. I couldn't begin to do those things. But they took the blood test and went home, and it was, I think, just within a couple weeks, they contacted us and said, you have DYT1 dystonia. And it was about the same time this news was hitting the dystonia world. There's this new gene deletion that's been discovered. And the New York City people said, but there's one problem. This kind of dystonia, DYT1, is a Jewish kind. It's not the Mennonite and Amish kind. We think probably the blood samples must have gotten mixed up in the mail or in carrying. So they wonder if we'd be willing to resend. We did, it came back. You have DYT1, dystonia. Same kind that the Jews have. The next section I have simply entitled Dr. Morton. Dr. Morton is a very special person to our family. How many have ever heard of Dr. Morton? Bless his heart. Miriam's sister was a nurse practitioner, and she told us, Dr. Morton is going to talk at a dystonia support group meeting. We went, and he was excited about a little boy named Leroy Stosfus, who had glutaric aciduria and had dystonic symptoms, and he was going to have a procedure done to Leroy's brain called a pallidotomy. And then, at the end of the lecture, Dr. Morton showed a video of a little Jewish boy who had had this procedure done. And we sat there and wept openly. There was this little boy with a walker. His symptoms were exactly like mine. It's the first we'd ever seen or heard of anyone with symptoms like mine. His foot had just turned under just like mine. And he was struggling up and down the hallways. And they had the surgery. Actually, the boy was in a wheelchair, I believe, at first. Within a week, they showed him walking up and down the halls with a walker. And a couple weeks later, he was running up and down the hallway. So, needless to say, we were exultant. But there was one holdback. A pallidotomy is a technique wherein they go in and actually deaden brain tissue. And the spot they deadened was very close to the speech centers, which would have been a big mistake for someone who was a school teacher. So we just held off. A year after we were married, Dr. Morton again showed his big open heart. He made the 1-hour trip up to our house in Lebanon County to visit us one evening. And his main mission was to convince us to go ahead with this procedure. There was a doctor in Toronto who was having really good success with this pallidotomy. They had refined the technique, and they were able to be testing the patient while the surgery was being done, make sure the speech is still retained. So my parents took us to Toronto, and everything was all set and go. They did say that they required a trial of medication, just in case if that would work, then they would hold off. But it was just a matter of protocol. You could tell no one around there thought it was going to do any good. But we started the medication, and a couple of days after we started, I was lying on the floor, which was the only comfortable position for me at that time. I said to Miriam, this stuff's doing me some good. And it was right over the time Leslie, our first child, was born. And it was pretty special to be experiencing these improvements in conjunction with that. And every week we would up the dosage a little bit. It was like it was another miracle. And I'm not sure how long it was. Within several months, we were walking in the church one time. By the way, I walked with forearm crutches and dragging my feet along. I said to Miriam, walking to church, when we got to the porch, this is kind of crazy because I'm feeling like I have to tap my crutches once in a while because I'm just carrying these crutches along. It's got looking like I'm not using my crutches. So we were very happy with the results of that medication. We had not had the brain surgery. The big drawback with the medication, we went way, way high on dosage. The doctors who heard about it just rolled their eyes and shook their heads. I'm not sure why our doctor who was prescribing the medication let us do it, but it caused depression, mind fog, anxiety, short-term memory loss, which is some of those things that are still pretty painful to think about. I had to stop teaching school because of these things. In the meantime, we met Dr. Rachel Saunders Pullman, a Jewish doctor from Manhattan, New York City, at Dr. Morton. There was a group of doctors there, and Dr. Morton wanted us to meet them. And she's another very special person in our lives. She convinced us that evening to just hold off, don't go get this polyotomy, because it's dead and it's irreversible. There's something new on the horizon. Just hold off if you can. We did. The next section, DBS, deep brain stimulation surgery. It's the same technique that's used for Parkinson's disease, where they go and implant electrodes in the midbrain, connect them to a battery pack, and then remotely control the frequencies and pulse widths, and get good results. Parkinson's disease often responds immediately. Unfortunately, because Parkinson's is a degenerative disease, the results usually don't last more than maybe 10 years. Dr. Altman, we saw him at Mount Sinai. We interviewed him. He interviewed us. And one of his first questions was, are you adopted? Because he made the Jewish connection. There were here these Mennonites with this DYT1 dystonia. He couldn't put that together. Another of his questions, this still chokes me up. He said, what about your insurance? What do you have? What insurance do you have? Well, we don't have insurance. Oh, well, there's no way. I mean, just as he was ready to say goodbye. And he said, well, our church will help us. And well, it has to be there the day of surgery. It has to have the money there. And the day of surgery, our deacon was in the hospital there with a $100,000 check. Another manifestation of God's grace during the surgery, Donald was talking about this halo. One thing that I was really dreading about the surgery was that the patient remains awake through the surgery so that they can be testing and have you speak, make sure your speaking is still normal. And of course, you need to be screwed into this halo. And keep in mind that the dystonic movements of just a constant pulling. And I wasn't sure how this is going to work, to be screwed into this halo for 8 to 10 hours. And but I remember when we were driving into the city, I turned to Miriam and said, I have virtually no apprehension about this surgery tomorrow. And as it turned out, they tried a couple of times to bring me out of sedation after they had the halo one, but my body just went into a dystonic storm. So I was under sedation for the whole surgery, but they were very positive. They thought they got good placement. Then we began visiting the neurologist regularly, and we noticed small improvements and along the way. One time I remember Rachel, we just called her Rachel, Dr. Saunders Pullman, asked, what are some of your goals? Tell me some of your goals that help us know what we should work at as far as changing these settings. I said, I would like to be able to stand up in church in front of our congregation and lead the singing. And Miriam told me later, her heart sank, and she thought, Dale, he'll never do that. Well, I feel very humbled that I was able the other year to go to our 3-week youth Bible school and lead the singing there. And they did make some adjustments for me at the program. This trusty bar stool has some extra holes in the feet. They built a platform so it would be up higher and screwed this seat on so that I'd have something to sit down on when I needed to during the singing. So they were changing these settings. Then about 3 years after the surgery was bing bang, things started happening, and it was just like one miracle after another, just tremendous improvement. Started to really decrease this troublesome medication, and I was really itching to get back into teaching school. There was an opportunity that opened in British Columbia. We moved to BC, lived there for 3 years, and teaching again, that was like being freed from a prison after 8 years in an office job. Out there, by the end of our stay there, I was off meds completely. So, now I'm sure you know that now I'm just holy. I'm holy and happy all the time. I'm never discouraged about anything. I never struggle with the fact that I have dystonia. God's done all these things to me, so I never have to grieve over the loss of healthy, normal growing up years. I never get angry that I haven't been able to do my childhood dream of being a dairy farmer. I'm never tempted to envy those who don't seem to have any financial worries. I never feel like anything but a perfectly sanctified saint. Turn to Matthew 26. Matthew 26, this is the story of the house of Bethany and the woman who broke open her alabaster box in sacrifice. It's only as we allow ourselves to be broken that the beauty and sweetness of worship can come forth. When I was looking at this passage, something stuck out to me that I never thought of before, and that is in verse 6, Matthew 26, 6. Now when Jesus was in Bethany, in the house of Simon the leper, it sounds like a miracle's coming, right? Simon's going to be healed? No, it just mentions that. Here's Simon the leper, and then it goes through the story, and we have no indication that Simon received any special attention. Jesus was here glorified in a wonderful way in the house of a physically challenged person. And from what we see here, that person still had the leprosy when Jesus left. Verse 12. For in that she hath poured this ointment in my body, she did it for my burial. Jesus will accept our sacrifice and use it for something marvelous, far beyond our expectations. This woman did not know she was preparing Jesus' body for his burial and the wonderful resurrection. As we surrender, as we give all to Jesus, as we make this full surrender, God can do some beautiful things in our lives. It's not a one-time thing. It's piece by piece. Why is it just piece by piece? Is it our stubbornness? Or is it his mercy that he just accepts us like that? He's willing to take us piece by piece. Probably some of both. I feel like a hypocrite sometimes to talk about how it's wonderful to be fully surrendered to whatever God has for me. Did you ever get the feeling that people who are physically challenged or other problems similar to that, or everyone just assumes they're some kind of saint, or maybe you never encountered that. You know, Fanny Crosby, you know, she was glad she was blind and that kind of thing. Well, we can be. But I'm sure there were times Fanny Crosby wished she wasn't blind. We don't know of her tears, her frustration, and her rage. Verse 2 talks about surrendering my feet. I already talked about that. I do remember at the Crippled Children's Hospital, I remarked later after we were there, I turned to my mom and said, "Mama, I was the best one there." Well, I think at that point, God was giving me grace as a little boy to understand his goodness. Yeah, I have a problem, but it's not as bad as a lot of other people are having. As I said before, my right foot, this verse talks about my hands. I still think of fourth grade as kind of a black hole in my school years. I still remember before school, struggling to get my reading workbook lesson done. I was right-handed, and by that time, I couldn't write with my right hand. I had to insert my left finger into my hand and tried to write as best as I could. Sorry. I kind of went back and forth from right hand and left through some of those years. I still remember in sixth grade, too, when one day we had to write a long memory passage, and I tried to start. I just couldn't get anywhere. I know I was a big sixth grade boy, but I had to cry. I told the teacher I'm not feeling well. I think I wasn't feeling very well in my heart. So, yeah, I needed to surrender those hands. Eventually, it spread throughout my body, and I have not retained a single part. I had to give up everything. I still remember the day I was at home. My mom and sisters were away, and I was alone in the house. I don't know how I discovered it. There's a hump on my upper back. My spine is starting to curve. And I was just horrified. I worked several hours that day just trying to exercise and stretch. I guess trying to prove to myself that it wasn't there, or try to make it go away. So surrendering my head, it's amazing how this verse talks about everything. Surrendering my head. That was hard because in my mid-teens, when youth are self-conscious and wanting to be like the other youth, I felt very conspicuous because my head was constantly pulling like that. That required surrender. After we learned about dystonia, we were at a nutritional counselor, and she had some old medical dictionaries. She got them out, and she read very matter-of-fact what the definition was for muscular deformity. She said it progresses relentlessly and often twists the patients into pretzel shapes. So was that what I had to look forward to? It really didn't bother me as much as it might have because we were just glad to have a diagnosis. We were just glad to have a word for what was wrong here. So I had to heal my whole body. Most everything was involved. The one exception was my voice. Often people with generalized dystonia are affected in their voice and they're not able to speak clearly. When I got the official diagnosis of DYT1 dystonia, it was labeled as moderately severe. And the only reason the adverb moderately was there was because my speech was not affected. God knew that I needed my voice to teach school. I did come to a crisis of surrender in relation to my voice about 8 years ago. I had my first flare-up of oral mandibular dystonia, which is a spasm of the jaw, sometimes involving the tongue. I realized at school, I'm having trouble speaking clearly. It's very tiresome speaking clearly. We talked to the neurologist in New York City, and she confirmed our suspicions. That's probably what it is. I was sure my students knew what was going on, but me and talked to one of the mothers, and I don't think they had noticed it. Thanks to God, it has been controlled very well with occasional rounds of medication. If it flares up, I take a medication that doesn't have bad side effects. So that's been a blessing. My heart. I needed to surrender my heart. I talked earlier about some of the strange diagnoses that I received along the way. And God used one of those strange diagnoses. It was a very well-meaning practitioner, but it just sent me over the edge in frustration and helplessness, and that's what brought me to faith in God. My head, surrendering my head, God saw fit to give me a good, healthy intellect. At age 19, I was asked to teach school, which was in itself a miracle. At that time, I was very uncomfortable even sitting. I needed to keep myself kind of wedged into my seat with my right leg pulled up under me. I had the students go up to the board and I would tell them what math problem to write. And I loved school from the start, and I'm finishing my 28th year. I have nothing to say but thank you, God, for what you gave to me. We were able to teach school in various places, Slavic Evangelical Baptist School in Salt Lake City, Paraguay, British Columbia, 3 years. I needed to surrender my money. Probably the most important benefit of teaching school was the fulfillment it offered. It did provide a needed income, but there were still times of plenty of opportunity for surrender, extra expenses, and not a very big income. One of the most sacred parts of this song is the surrender of my love. And I've asked my dear Miriam to come up and talk about that from her perspective.
So when Dale told me that he wanted me to tell this part of the story, and I didn't think that I really should. I said, well, the rest of it is your story. I think you should just do it on. He said, well, our courtship and marriage was probably more of a surrender on your part than what it was on mine. I said, well, I guess that's probably right. But when I realized that he was using this song, I was just kind of dumbfounded, because my mind suddenly jumped back about 30 years ago, exactly. It was mid-July, and we had just finished a week of summer Bible school, and we had used this song as our theme song. And I remembered that I had just pondered it deeply each night, and sometimes I just felt like I couldn't hardly sing, because I just wasn't sure where everything was. And especially that line about my life, my love, and as a 30-year-old, I thought I had surrendered that normal desire of most young girls to get married and to have a charming boyfriend and your own home and all of that. And it was not easy. I had gone through some struggles, but I had done that. And I felt like I was actually living the life of my dreams. I was in Guatemala with mission work. And that's what I had wanted to do for a long time. And God finally opened that door. And I was, I had been there for the school term, and I had been home for, I just had come home for a couple months, and I was going back for another 2-year commitment. But in my mind, I was just gonna give my whole life. That's where I was just gonna stay there at least 10 years, and I was hopefully maybe for the rest of my life. So we had sung that song, and if you notice, I mean, when you sang it this morning, you said 25 times, I've surrendered all, or I've given all to Jesus. And we did that for 5 nights, so that's 125 times. That was that week. And on Saturday, everything changed. I had been with some other youth girls, and we had an outing, and I came home, and I was opening the mail while I was telling the family all about what we had done that day, and there were two envelopes for me. They were legal size envelopes, and my name was typed on it. And the thought flittingly went through my mind that this is probably the editor of the School Builder want me to write an article for the School Builder. I was a school teacher or whatever. I mean, and I was talking and wasn't paying any attention, and I opened the envelope, and all of a sudden I just sort of stopped, and I realized that this was not a letter from the editor of the school board. This was a letter from a young man asking for my friendship. But there was no name signed to the bottom.
I like to do surprises.
He said enough in his letter that I knew who it was. He talked about his handicap and his sister, so I knew who it was. And this is not the typical thing to do whenever you get a letter from a boy, but I don't always do typical things, I guess. But anyway, the people that I lived with, it was like my family, we were just sitting there talking, and he was sitting there on the sofa beside me, and I just handed the letter to him, and I said, "What do you think of this?" And he read it, and he said, "Well, the man's got something between his ears." A very typical Mervyn Lemon fashion. Can't you just, you know him? Anyway, I opened the second letter, and it was a two-sentence letter that said, "My face is very red because I just realized that I forgot to sign that last letter." So what? Your mom took it to the post office?
Well, see, I did everything on tape. I printed on computer, and then, of course, I did not sign it on the computer, and I wanted to sign it with a handwritten signature, but I forgot to. So did we put it in the mailbox?
No, you took I think your mother took it to the post office.
And all at once I came, "Mom, I just know I forgot to sign that letter." So she printed
it on.
Yeah, and she ran into the post office. They got there the same day.
They got there the same day, and I happened to open the first one first. I guess it was of the Lord. Anyway, so I started thinking about this song again. I spent the next few weeks praying and counseling with a lot of people, and finally I came to the decision that I needed to learn to know Dale as a person. The handicap laid aside. I needed to learn to know Dale as a person. And he had kind of suggested that if I was interested in pursuing a relationship, that we should have a kind of a preliminary meeting where he could discuss his handicap and the implications, and we could talk about that. So I had sent him a letter and told him that I was willing to pursue, I was interested in pursuing this relationship. So he came to visit for our preliminary visit, and talked about it over, and he suggested that I could have more time to think about it. But I had already been committed that I was ready to learn to know him, and I knew that if I waited, all I was going to focus on was the physical, and that's not what I had committed to do. So I told him, "Let's go ahead," although I didn't really want to say that, that's what I said. So we had decided that we were going to let it become public knowledge. But I will admit that after he left, I felt horrible. I'm sorry, but I feel very vulnerable now, but this is very real. I told a friend of mine this week that that at Penn Valley we can be very honest, and that's one of the special things about Penn Valley, is we can be honest and everybody understands. But I do feel very, very vulnerable because I'm not sure. I think there's people, I kind of disagree with Dale's whatever. I think there's more perfect wives here that have probably been more selfless. Okay, let's go. But anyway, there was two things. First of all, he was much worse than what I had remembered. I knew that, you know, in thinking about with a man that couldn't walk very well, that was one thing, but I just did not know if I could live with that constant motion, that constant movement. And there's just no way you can understand it now, but he gave you a little bit of how it was. Could I handle that? And the second thing was, what will people think and say? And I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed to admit that that was a struggle for me. But I faced it over and over again in our courtship whenever we would come to a new situation or a new meet new people or new, is what will people say. I would like to say, though, that I got over that. And actually, by the time of our wedding, I didn't really care. We had a very unique wedding ceremony with me sitting, with him sitting and him on his crutches and walking out, and that really didn't bother me by that time. But anyway, I was going back to Guatemala, so I went back to Guatemala 3 weeks later. We were together two or three times, and then I went back to Guatemala, and so we began a long-distance courtship. Now, remember, 30 years ago, we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have our emails, we didn't have letters, took two or three weeks to get there. We didn't have, the only way to talk on the phone was to go to the administrator's house, which was not a very private place, and, yes, we must run along. So we finally came to the realization that I had to go back to the, I was learning to know him, but I needed to deal this physically, and so I went back for a visit, for a one-month visit, and then went back to Guatemala and decided that I needed to ask the board to release me from my two-year commitment. And I was going to go home. And I was leaving the land of my dreams, not knowing whether I was going home to get married or whether I was going home to break up. I just didn't know. And that took a lot of surrender. When Dale came, school was over, he came down to visit. And that was probably, for me, that was the roughest part of our courtship. Guatemala was not a very hand, it's just rough. You do a lot of walking, it's just rough life. And he couldn't do those things. And I didn't know what to do, I was very frustrated. I remember the school picnic where all the men went outside and what were we supposed to do? We had to sit inside at a table. And just a lot of things like that, and I just didn't know. In preparing for this topic, I read back over my journal and some letters that I had written to a very close friend over that time, and I was surprised by the amount of times that the word surrender and altar came up. Now, I suppose normal courtships are some of those things too, but I never had a normal courtship, if you want to call it that, so I can't compare it. But it would be untruthful to say that once I decided that this is the way it was going to be, that was it. I guess there's just a continual surrendering. But God did lead us, and it became apparent, and love blossomed, and we were married a year later. There were still opportunities for surrendering. I remember the day of we were setting up before the wedding, and there just wasn't much that he could do. He would just sit there. And that was hard to accept. And on our wedding trip, I did the driving, and he spent most of the time in the back seat, lying on the seat. There's things that we couldn't do on our wedding trip that I always imagined if you took a wedding trip that we would do. After we get back home, I remember setting up the house. This is supposed to be a wonderful thing that, you work together and you put mottos on the walls and you put everything away. And he lay on the sofa and watched me do it. And I loved him, but that was difficult. That was really hard. The limited social life, there was many times we skipped weddings, or I would go to them by myself, or I would go to church by myself because he just didn't have the physical wherewithal to do it. Those are just a few examples of the things that I needed to surrender. And I guess, maybe we still do because I still go to church without him sometimes. But God has just blessed us in tremendous ways. And I just need to remember that. I have to remember all those things that were struggles for me. They were struggles for him too, because he wanted to do all those things for me. And couldn't. So it wasn't just a struggle for me, it was just learning to do this together. But I want to say that that there's no other place I would rather be. And Penn Valley helps.
Thank you, God. There's one more thing that I would like to touch on, and that is surrendering my family. I mentioned that DYT1 is a genetic dystonia. So, of course, the question came up, should we have children? And we talked to our minister, Stanley Wine, and he didn't really hold us back. He encouraged us that he doesn't see any reason why we should not do that. Remember, this was still when I was very severely handicapped. There was a possibility this surgery on the horizon was quite uncertain. And I remember, was that right after we were married, we were here? When the physically challenged and mentally challenged were still together as one retreat? And we talked to the coordinator of that event who had a child or two that had a genetic disorder, and we talked to him, and I still remember his words. If you got counsel and you're comfortable with it, go for it. Maybe that sounds reckless, but we felt comfortable with that. God blessed us with two dear boys, Leslie and Joshua. They're both married. We had three grandchildren. We were advised not to have them genetically tested until they're adults, because this dystonia can be triggered by a trauma, which is probably a connection to that fall I had before 9 months. So if you know they have this gene, you'll tend to already protect them. They won't have a normally rough bumping growing up. We decide that those results are going to be kept private, so any remarks from here on are intentionally veiled. So, as our boys were growing up, that conscience, that question was always there. Is Leslie going to have dystonia? When's Joshua going to start? And as they reached their teenage years, they got into teens, we started to breathe more easily. I think they said, there's still a possibility until they reach age 30. Years 8 to 12 starts, and there's a possibility until they're age 30. Leslie's 26, but there's still Carson and Sophia and little Adeline. We don't know. Finally, we just came to the place where we'd often, in our prayers at night, dear God, what do we want? Is that we and our children and our grandchildren, until you come again, that we'll all be in heaven. Whatever that takes. That takes dystonia. We'll surrender to that. I want to close by saying that I just need to crawl up on this altar, surrender again and again. And may God bless you as you experience His grace.